From the Sky News Centre at 5, British Airways passengers are flying into a storm of industrial unrest. Cabin crew are to strike for 7 days over a 10-day period from March the 20th, following a failure to secure agreement on the airline's cost-cutting measures. The Prime Minister's urged both sides to continue talking.
The disruption to services is completely unacceptable. This difficulty will place passengers who already booked the flights or are planning flights in a very difficult position. And this is bad news if this happens for the British economy.
The mother and stepfather of a seven-year-old girl starved to death have been handed lengthy prison terms. Kyra Ishak died in May 2008 after suffering months of cruelty at her home in Birmingham. In sentencing, the judge described the couple's mistreatment of the child as chilling in its harshness and cruelty. The BNP has been forced to rewrite its constitution after a judge ruled its new membership rules discriminated against non-whites. The far-right party was ordered to close its membership list until it complies with race laws. Susie Apple from the Equality and Human Rights Commission says it's a very clear ruling.
He's told them what they have to do, and they now have to do it. If they don't do it, they're going to be held in contempt of court, and there will be consequences that will flow on from that. I mean, the court could potentially send people to prison or could actually fine them.
The House of Lords is to investigate Baroness Udin's expenses claims. The Crown Prosecution Service announced earlier that no criminal charges would be brought against the Labour peer. The average price of petrol is now above the 115 pence a litre mark. The RAC says drivers have been hit with a 27% increase over the last 12 months. 160 Metallica fans have been arrested while trying to force their way into one of the band's gigs in Colombia. 30,000 people have gone to the concert in Bogota, but hundreds more try to get in without tickets. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
It seemed too good to be true.
My flight leaves on Monday.
10 weeks making a difference in countries like South Africa, India and Peru.
They need a block of toilets building for their village.
Thousands of 18 to 25 year olds from the UK.
And I don't have to pay for the flights, food, accommodation, vaccinations.
What? How'd you manage that? Who pays?
Platform 2. Volunteering abroad for 18 to 25-year-olds who've always wanted to help out overseas but couldn't afford it. Funded by the Department for International Development. No need to use life savings or have rich parents. If you're 18 to 25 and have or are eligible for a UK passport, go to myplatform2.com or phone 0800-988-6828.
Wow! Myplatform2.com or 0800-988-6828.
It's no movie fantasy. Platform 2, your platform to change your world.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Mondays at 5, it's Tom Bigwood. Tuesdays, it's Dan and Laura. Wednesdays, Ryan and Sam. Thursdays, Phil Gibbons, but Fridays... Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and our guest, on the day when Bristol is officially confirmed as Britain's most musical city, to review the week's news, is Lib Dem councillor for Cabot Ward and chair of the Central Planning Committee, Alex Woodman. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, who is attacking our civil liberties? Is it terrorists or the government or both? Drive Time's Richard Cowley reports on the Inquiries Act 2005 and why it may make it even more difficult to get to the truth. We also take a look at today's revelations in the Daily Mail about the death of Princess Diana by Al Fayed's barrister Michael Mansfield. And in the week of the first court appearance in the expenses crisis, we ask, who is ex-SAS Major John Wick, the man with a copy of the private House of Commons hard drive, who started it all? That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, temperatures averaging around 7 degrees Celsius and dry with sunny spells. Next week, averaging a little bit up, 9 degrees, a fairly dry week with plenty of sunny spells, some rain though towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 20th and 21st of March, a little cooler, averaging 6. in the daytime. Cloudy but dry with a few sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news. And joining us is Lib Dem councillor for Cabot Ward and chair of the Central Planning Committee, Alex Woodman. Alex, welcome to Drive Time.
Thanks, Tony.
Now, first of all, are you from Bristol?
No, I'm from Lincoln, actually, up in the chilly north. But my dad was from Bristol. He was born in Southmead. And he moved to Lincoln, met my mum. I was born and I've moved back.
Okay. Do you have a day job as well? Or are you just, do you just dedicate your entire life to being a councillor?
No. I do have a day job. And it was actually through my day job that I ended up being a councillor. I work as a caseworker for Stephen Williams, the MP for Bristol West. So I give people tax benefits, housing, immigration advice when they contact Stephen for help. And it was through working for Stephen that I got involved in politics in Bristol and decided in 2007 that I wanted to stand for the council.
So you're on the Central Planning Committee and you're chair of it. Now, that sounds like a very important job, because there's lots and lots of pressure, from the developers to have these wonderful new developments, which are great for them, but they're not always what the local people want, are they?
Oh, absolutely. And making decisions on planning applications is always a very challenging and very difficult thing to do. But I think that the most controversial applications always come to a committee of elected councillors who are there to serve the people of Bristol, and hopefully we make the right decisions on most, if not all of them.
Okay, so what are you working on right now?
Well, the applications come to the committee chair about 2 weeks before the meeting for him to look over and decide, and I actually had that meeting on Monday of this week. Interestingly, the applications that are coming to the next committee meeting come from outside of the central area. Although we have three committees in Bristol, there's quite a lot of applications that get moved between the committees so that we can balance the workload. So we've got a couple of controversial applications for housing in King's Weston Ward in Seamills, and then there are a couple of applications in East Bristol as well, again, also for housing.
What newspaper do you read? Do you have a favourite daily paper?
Well, I'm inclined to say the Evening Post, of course, as a Bristol resident, but no, in national papers, I read The Independent.
Okay, and what about if you were Chancellor of the Exchequer, how would you be dealing with this financial crisis? I know it's a biggie, but have you any thoughts about it all?
I have to say I'm glad I'm not the Chancellor, in all honesty. The economic crisis is obviously a pretty difficult issue to deal with, and I was elected to serve people in my ward, and it's interesting being involved in community politics, and I don't pretend to have a great deal of knowledge of the national issues, so I wouldn't want to go into.
Okay, right. That's okay. You can cop out there if you want to, but Martin, I'm sure, won't do. Martin Summers, our old Labour pundit and economist, is here too. Martin, the Labour government's saying this week that they're going to have to cut redundancy payments for public servants. That's represented by Public Service Union PCS, who had a strike earlier this week. Yet there's always enough money for the banks and bonuses for the bankers. Surely both of these things can't be true at the same time.
I'm afraid they are, and as the PCS have pointed out, when bankers said that their contracts were inviolable, the government backed off and said, well, we'll have to pay them because they've signed their contracts. Why doesn't that apply to low-paid workers? And of course, if you reduce the redundancy payout to public employees, that makes it easier to sack them because it's actually cheaper. Now, if you have to pay them properly what their contracts say, then it actually doesn't make it cheap to get rid of them, and you might as well keep them. And I think it's a thin end of a wedge of attempting to dismantle the public sector, which is already going on with a Labour government in place.
But what's the motive behind something like that? Dismantling the public sector?
Well, we're being pushed into the wrong direction. I don't know whether Alex would like to comment on this, but Nick Clegg this week is starting to talk the same language as the other party leaders, which is that we've got to cut public expenditure. I think that we've got to keep credibility on British borrowing, so that there's a certain point we can't just keep printing money. Nevertheless, we do need a certain amount of slack, fiscal slack, that is to say deficit financing. Every serious economists know that that's what you do in a crisis. At the same time, I would argue that we've actually got to increase public investment in all sorts of infrastructure and human skills, which will pull us out of the recession. And if we say we can't afford to do that, then I say phooey, we've got to find the money to do that. And that possibly means raising taxes on those who can afford to pay, who've done so well out of the last 30 years.
So what's your answer, Alex, for those that say, hang on, if it's good enough to throw money at the bankers and
why isn't it good enough to look after public employees like the people who were on strike this week?
Well, no, actually, I agree with Martin, you may be surprised to hear. I agree that I think we do need to invest in infrastructure and skills, and there comes a point, though, where you have to recognise that public expenditure is going to be cut, and I can think of plenty of examples of waste in the public sector, not necessarily in frontline services or in staff, but wasteful projects that we could quite easily cut without seeing any necessary...
Trident, for example?
Well, exactly. That's just one example. The identity card scheme's another. There are lots and lots of projects that the Labour government have been pursuing that, frankly, we could do without. And so I think when Nick Clegg starts to talk about cuts, he's not talking about laying off lots of public sector staff, for example. I think we're talking about those kinds of... those big budget items that we don't really need. So... I agree. The one thing that did leap to my attention from the news today actually was the announcement on high speed rail between London and Birmingham, and France managed to build the TGV in 4 years, yet we've got the government talking about it taking 17 years to build one railway line from London to Birmingham. That's exactly the kind of infrastructure project that the government should be investing in.
Martin, do you agree with that?
Yes, I do, and I think there's a wide degree of consensus emerging about what we need to do. I mean, Vince Cable, for it, in my view, should be Chancellor of the Exchequer as we speak, and maybe he will be in either a Labour-led or a Conservative-led government.
Well, as a Labour Party member, you're going to get your knuckles wrapped for saying that.
Well, no, I'm not, because don't forget that Vince Cable was John Smith's economic advisor and was a Labour Party member for many, many years. I'm not entirely convinced that he has got the measure of the crisis. I don't think any of the political class has, but out of the people at the top, he's the one who's talked the most sense.
Right, let's move on to look at some of this week's stories, and we're starting this week with a rather peculiar one. It's a big international story which has hardly been touched by the mainstream media, and it's about something called Ergenekon. Now, Ergenekon apparently is a coup plot in Turkey, and we have had some very senior retired and serving army officers and army officials, including managers of large media concerns in Turkey, all arrested because of something called the sledgehammer. Apparently, the sledgehammer was a plot to take over the government and cause all sorts of disruption in Turkey and basically run a military coup. Now, Martin, what do you know about this Ergenekon plot?
Well, this network, the Ergenekon network, has not just come into view. It's been suspected to exist inside the Turkish state structure for decades.
One of the things that's just come out in the last 10 days or so is that a serving general and the chief prosecutor in the government have been charged in this case as well. So that's a little bit like our director of public prosecutions being arrested and charged.
It is, but you've got to remember that in Turkey there have been three military coups in the last generation. And in the lead up to those military coups, there was usually all kinds of terrorist activity going on. Right-wing terrorists were blowing things up, left-wing terrorists were blowing things up, Islamist terrorists were blowing things up. Now, it isn't in the documents you've got in front of us, but some of the hard drives that have been seized by the Turkish police link the military leadership to many of the terrorist actions inside Turkey, which then led up to coups. So you get the picture here. It's a kind of strategy of tension. The secret service behind the army are carrying out terrorist attacks, going, ooh, we need some order here. Then the military takes over, and the military, of course, are answerable ultimately to NATO, to the Americans.
Is this a story you'd come across at all, Alex? Because I mean, most people I've spoken to, I didn't even know it was taking place, even though it's such a massive story in Turkey.
No, exactly. Until you mentioned it to me, it was the first I'd heard of it, and it's perhaps unsurprising in a way that the mainstream media haven't picked up on it.
The thing is that this is all in Turkey, isn't it? And Turkey is a Muslim country. It's part of NATO. It's right on the eastern edge of NATO. Therefore, you'd have thought that it would be even more important, not less important.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. And I think there's a lot to be desired in the way the mainstream media report international affairs. And I'm grateful in a way that we have things like the internet to be able to get our news from alternative sources.
Right, Martin, so what do you think is going to be the outcome here? Is it not possible that the government has been encouraging the police to arrest their political opponents simply?
Their political opponents, but they're not playing by the rules. And if the army doesn't play by the rules, the police have to enforce the rules. And we saw that in Northern Ireland, for example, with Sir John Stevens' investigation of Brigadier Gordon Kerr and the Force Research Unit. Eventually, the army were forced to concede through police investigation that they were involved in terrorism. And we've had our own... I mean, people in Northern Ireland will be very familiar with this, but again, people in Bristol probably less so. And I think ultimately that's the bottom of the peace process in Northern Ireland, is the acceptance by all sides of the community that the police must enforce the law against everybody without fear or favour. And if that means people inside the state structure, then so be it. And that is the basis of peace. And nothing that the police are doing in Turkey is against the Turkish law. They're complaining now because they're being held without trial and so on. But I mean, that's the Turkish law. If you're an ordinary criminal in Turkey, you can be held. And what these generals are saying is, you do know who I am. I'm in charge of the army. They're saying, we know exactly who you are, general. You're coming down to the station to answer a few questions.
So you think, though, even though this is such a long way away, the other side of Europe, that it does have some
implications. It's got very, very important implications, because if you remember the bomb attack on the British embassy in Ankara in the week that George Bush came to visit Britain, that terrorist group was an Islamist terrorist group which had links to the Turkish army and had been used by the Turkish army to assassinate their Kurdish opponents in the Kurdish region of Turkey. Now, that suggests it's possible, well, I will say no more than that, that US and Israeli intelligence were involved with the Turkish army in bombing the British embassy. Now, I'm not saying that's true, I'm not saying it's not true, but that's the kind of thing that could be dug out here. Don't forget that the Turkish military are all trained at Sandhurst.
But what would they have to gain from something like that?
What would they have to... Who's they that would have something to gain? I mean, when you say
the
they...
Israelis,
you mean don't forget that you've got a democratic, moderate Islamist government in Turkey. For example, they cancelled a military exercise with the Israelis earlier this year. They're starting to become very critical of the Israelis, critical of American policy. They are the democratically elected government, and they are a democratic government, and they stand in elections and they get beaten or they don't get beaten on the electoral basis. Now, what the Western powers are scared of is Turkey drifting out of their control. And you'll notice, for example, that Turkey refused to participate in the assault on Iraq. The Americans wanted to use the Incirlik air base, and the Turks told them no. So the Turkish army is very well linked into NATO, and in previous incarnations when they've taken power, it's been basically at the behest of Washington.
Right, a little bit closer to home. This is the psychiatric report, apparently, into James Bulger's killer, John Venables, said he posed only a trivial threat. A psychiatric assessment of James Bulger's killer, John Venables, compiled before his release, said he posed only a trivial risk to the public. An account reported in a national newspaper formed part of the legal case for Venables' release under his new identity. Now, first of all, let's start with the brass tacks here. Alex, what are your thoughts about giving a new identity to these young killers?
I think that justice isn't served when you have vigilantism, and I think if the way you prevent vigilantism is from giving a killer a new identity, then so be it. It's an unfortunate necessity.
Would you extend that to, you know, older, maybe teenagers and adults as well?
No, I think that once you reach the age of 18, there comes a point where you have to take accountability and be responsible for your own actions. But John Venables was only 10 years old when he murdered Jamie Bulger. I don't see that it's in any way a benefit to society for somebody who's now a grown man to face the prospect of potentially a violent attack for something that he did 17 years ago. I'll give you another example that always sticks in my mind with this, and that's whenever the tabloid media start talking about the threat of paedophiles or wanting to name paedophiles, and you always end up with a small string of attacks on paedietricians as a result.
Yes, it happened in Brighton, didn't it?
Exactly. It's exactly that kind of problem that means that we have to protect the identities of people like John Venables as much as that's an unpleasant thing to have to do.
But this psychiatric report's a bit worrying, isn't it? Because it's saying he's only a trivial threat. I mean, he's clearly gone on to offend again, whatever he's done.
Well, we don't know what he's done at the moment, so it could
Should
be
we know?
No, I don't think we should. If there are criminal charges being made against John Venables, then I don't think that it's in anybody's interest to possibly prejudice any court case by having this raft of media attention focused on what he may have
done. But he's over 18 now, isn't he?
He is. But I think this is in a way a very special case. He's an incredibly notorious criminal. The case has obviously got the media incredibly interested, and I think that at the end of the day, justice is best served if we allow him to have a fair and a reasonable trial without the media wanting to stick its nose in, ultimately with a view to selling newspapers.
Well, that's what the media does all the time, isn't it, for every story. But anyway, Martin.
Well, I'd just like to second all of that. I agree entirely with what Alex has just said.
So you don't think that now the fact that he's recommitted another offence...
We don't know that he's committed a offence. He's not been charged with anything at the moment. What's happened is he's done something to upset people, so he's been put back in prison because of a preventative thing. We don't really know what he has or hasn't done. Now, if he has committed a serious offence, he'll be charged in due course, and therefore we shouldn't talk about it because we're prejudicing a future trial. I mean, that's quite clear. I mean,
well, we can talk about it in measured terms, can't we? Because we don't know any of the details
Can I make a wider point about children and child abuse and the kind of media hysteria that goes on around this? As I've said before on this programme, a Labour MP, a woman MP whose name I'm afraid I've forgotten, made a point during the Baby P case in the House of Commons, and she said, every year in Britain, 250 children are murdered by their carers. Murdered. That means that those that are abused could be maybe 10 times as much. Of that 250 who are murdered, where we've got a dead body on our hands, only 60 were previously known to social services. So we've got a huge problem with child abuse in this country. Massive. And it's probably no different in other parts of the world. Now, we should be paying attention to these problems, and we should be talking about them. But we should talk about them in a reasoned voice and in a sensible way. These children were themselves victims when they were 10 years old. They didn't have much of a chance, which is why we give them a second chance, because they were only children.
Jamie Bulger was the victim.
Indeed, and so were the boys themselves. I'm not saying that Jamie Bulger wasn't a victim, but demonising a 10-year-old boy is not failing to face up to the fact that 250 people, children every year, are killed by their carers. And so, we don't get upset about it. Well, we do get upset about it, but most people have got no sense of proportion about it.
Do you think the media can have any other reaction other than hysteria? Because that's what you seem to be most annoyed
about. Well, I don't think that's terribly helpful. We've got a real problem with child abuse, but the hysteria doesn't help anything, does it?
Can the media report it in a balanced way, or is it only hysteria that you've seen?
I'm afraid there's a huge amount of hysteria, and I don't suppose Alex is going to disagree with me.
No, I'm not. I'm afraid I agree. There's been a huge amount of hysteria, and I don't think that it helps anybody to allow the media to whip up a big storm out of what John Venables may or may not have done. Ultimately, if he has broken a law, then charges will be pressed against him, and he'll have a trial, and punishment potentially will follow if he's found guilty.
One of the things that's really made this rather messy is the fact that John Venables apparently was confessing left, right and centre to his real identity, to total strangers in the run-up. So doesn't it make a bit of a farce of this attempt to keep him anonymous when he himself is going to people and saying, oh, my real name's John Venables?
He may be throwing away his second chance, which is sad for him, but he should have been given a second chance. If he throws it away, that's up to him, isn't it?
Okay, on to the next story. And Manchester police are blaming David Askew's death on the Manchester Council. An 18-year-old man apparently was being quizzed in relation to Mr. Askew's death. Now, this is the horrific case of a man with learning difficulties who had been being harassed over several years by a gang of youths. Again, this is youngsters going astray. Neighbours said apparently the abuse had gone on for years with the man Yobs nicknaming him Dopey Dave and gathering outside his house regularly, taunting him. Children taunting him were as young as 8. One said Mr. Askew had been tormented to death like bear baiting. Now, why is it that we're always faced with buck passing in this sort of situation, with the council blaming the police, police blaming the council?
It's obviously a very tragic case, and we're still at the early stages of trying to find out what's gone on. And I know that Manchester Police have referred themselves voluntarily to the Independent Police Complaints Commission to investigate. I think that antisocial behaviour is a very difficult issue to tackle. It's often... in some of our communities, it runs to the very core of the community, and... I think that despite the powers that have been given to the council and the new powers for the police, coming up with one single easy answer to antisocial behaviour isn't possible. And I think that in lots of circumstances, there are responsibilities of the police and there are responsibilities of the council. And when a case like this is splashed all over the media, I think that the instant reaction is simply to say, well, it wasn't us, it was the police, or it wasn't us, it was the council. And I think that both the police and the council have gone on the defence here. They've something terrible has happened, and they don't want necessarily to give the impression that they've done something wrong. I think that when we know more about what exactly the circumstances were, then we can start to think about ways that we can stop this from happening again.
Well, I agree with that. It is very difficult to deal with antisocial behaviour. Each of the small incidents where somebody calls you a name is not in itself an offence that's of any great gravity.
It's happened over many years.
Yes, but of course
years,
it happens every day, all day, it goes on
Martin,
and on and on.
Can I just finish? Yeah. If it happens over many years, then surely it's a case of concerted harassment, and surely the police should be intervening.
Well, maybe they should, but it's how do you prove that somebody's harassed somebody if nobody...
Well, they had CCTV cameras on the guy's house.
Well, maybe. I mean, but you can see that you can see the difficulties here with trying to keep track of such low level harassment. It's not technically easy.
No, and in this particular case, as you mentioned, Tony, the police did install CCTV cameras on Mr. Askew's house. There was mention of undercover officers spending the evening in the house to try and catch the perpetrators of this antisocial behaviour. I don't know whether the council felt that the police had it in hand, and the police at the same time felt that the council could have done more. Who knew? But that an investigation's going on, and we'll wait to see what the result is.
And maybe the little tow rags concerned ought to take some of the blame as well, if we're talking about saying who's to blame for things.
Well, I mean,
people are to blame for their own behaviour. And that, you know, we're demonising Jamie Bulger, but the children, if that's what they were, who've done this, are somehow not being put in the blame frame. That's not right.
I know. I was hearing also earlier on today that there is a meeting at Temple Meads, I think it's Wednesday or Thursday next week in the city, about antisocial behaviour organised by the police. So, you know, maybe to stop this kind of thing happening in the city, that might be useful for people to trolley along there. But I will stick with this whole thing of... Do you think the police these days are a bit afraid of taking on youngsters because of the fact that they may see that that the youngsters are maybe taking the mickey out of the police, in the fact that they are, it is impossible to prosecute them for very minor offences, and the police are much more likely to take on adults maybe than they are young groups of gangs of youths like this?
It's almost a cliche really, but I think the police's biggest problem is bureaucracy. And I know obviously the police officers in my ward, and I know they are incredibly hardworking and incredibly committed, and they work very hard for the local community. But when you have a situation where they want to arrest somebody and they end up spending hours filling in forms explaining why they were arrested or the circumstances, I think that it limits their ability to be out there walking the streets and dealing with some of those issues. But there's a broader problem with society here as well, I think, which is that 30 or 40 years ago, I think a little old lady walking down the road who saw a young person misbehaving themselves would have no problem with pointing her finger and saying, "Oi, you behave." Whereas today, I think there is that reluctance by people to actually call people on what they're doing and say, "You shouldn't be doing that." And I know it applies to me as well. I walk down the street and I see somebody doing something antisocial, and I think, well, I should say something to them. I should tell them not to drop that piece of litter, or I should tell them not to be kicking that fence or whatever it is that they're doing. But you always ask yourself, well, if I do that, am I going to find myself having stones thrown at me? In fact, that did happen to me, funnily enough, a few years ago. I was in Southmead, and I saw a bunch of youth throwing stones at a bus, and I was so irritated by this, I turned around and I shouted at them, "Stop doing that!" So they threw the stones at me instead. And I think since then, I probably have been one of those people who has been reluctant to say anything.
What about Martin? Are you the sort of person that will speak up when you see youths misbehaving?
Well, it depends on the circumstances and how many of them there are and what's going on. I think what the police will tell you is that a small minority of young people create most of the problems. And if you can identify who they are and intervene with them, you might have some chance of dealing with the problem. It is actually a tiny minority that give a bad name to everybody else. One individual criminal, for example, can carry out hundreds of burglaries. And the police pretty much know who they are. The problem is that you can't just lock people up without due process. And in any case, that many of the things that they're doing are not major crimes anyway. You're not going to go to prison for throwing stones at a bus unless you seriously injure somebody. We need to have safer communities in which the police are trusted by the community. The community trusts the police. I mean, in the past, I used to live in Brixton before the first riots. There was no trust between the police and the community, and that was a very difficult situation. So you don't want to box yourself into that corner.
Don't you think that this is largely to do with simply the morals that children are brought up with. That they have to do some sort of... I mean, certainly when I was a lad, it was quite largely self-policed. I mean, you know, we weren't perfect little people. Listen, but we would never, ever go and do the sort of concerted harassment.
We've had a pool of mass unemployment in this country since the 1980s. So you've got people whose fathers have never worked, their brothers have never worked, they have no prospect of work. The structure by which young lads used to have their wild fun and then they get settled down and get somebody pregnant and buy a car, that's gone for a lot of young people. There is no structure for them. Think of all the young people leaving school last summer who are still unemployed as we speak, who have no structure in their lives. That's a huge problem.
Well, it's 5:30 just about now, and time to take a break from our news review and to hear our guest Alex Woodman's choice of music. Alex, what's the song you've chosen and why did you choose it?
Well, Tony, you asked me to choose my favourite song, and to be honest, I don't really have a favourite song. I listen to music depending on what mood I'm in. So I spent a long time thinking about this, and I didn't want to end up sounding like one of those politicians who chose something that was popular at the moment just to sound hip and trendy. But at the same
Arctic
time...
Arctic Monkeys.
Exactly. So no Arctic Monkeys today. Instead, I ended up choosing a song called After Hours by the Blue Tones. Now, the reason I like the Blue Tones is because I'm a bit of an indie rock fan, but when my wife and I first met, it was my birthday shortly afterwards, and she asked me to tell her what I wanted as a gift, and I'm one of those annoying people who never knows what he wants, says, oh, I don't want anything. But even though we'd only been together for a couple of months, she knew me well enough to know I like the Blue Tones, and she bought me tickets to go and see them at the Fleet on St. Thomas Street. And so this was the song that first got me listening to the Blue Tones, and I thought I would pick it, and if you don't mind, I'd like to say it's for my wife, Lucy.
Stay.
Okay, that was After Hours by the Blue Tones, chosen by today's guest on BCFM 93.2's Friday Drive Time, Alex Woodman, who's Lib Dem councillor for Cabot Ward, amongst many other things. We have a BCFM online survey at the moment on our website. That is at www.bcfm.org.uk. It really does only take 5 minutes. I tried it myself. You can also do lots more on the website, get volunteer forms, submit programme ideas, and see the schedule or listen again. That's at bcfm.org.uk. Now, back to our review of the week's news. And there's an event coming up tomorrow at Eastern Community Centre. That's Saturday 13th of March from 10am to 5pm. This is the Bristol Convention of the Left. Well, being an old Labour man, Martin, I'm sure you're going to have something to say about this.
I'm going to be one of the people leading the economics and unemployment discussion tomorrow. But first, Ken Loach, the filmmaker, is going to speak at 10:30, I believe. And then the idea is that we're all going to break up into different workshops to discuss aspects of policy with those that are interested.
Well, earlier this week, I had a chat with one of the organisers, Dan Isles.
Dan is, I believe, a politics student at Bristol University, and it was his initiative to get this discussion together. And he said, why don't we get together all
the Dan Isles.
Left-leaning people in the city for a discussion? And we've actually got quite a wide spectrum of groups and individuals represented. The Labour Party will be there and others.
OK, so let's go to Dan Isles, who's going to tell us about this Convention of the Left tomorrow.
My name's Dan Isles, and I've been involved in organising an event called the Bristol Convention of the Left in Bristol for the 13th of March. It's just the fact that it's a run-up to election coming up maybe in May, but it's just the fact that Bristol, I can see, is a kind of a budding radical city. There's different campaigns going across. There's a feminist campaign, there's anarchist campaigns, the political parties are active, there's unions involved. I think it's worth bringing all these different campaigns together so that they can find a ways of uniting and strategising to have a more coherent sort of leftish approach to politics.
Are we going to have lots of stuffy, boring left-wing speakers?
No. The idea about it is okay, against platform politics. So it's not about sort of asking questions to a panel and they give lots of wordy answers about, you know, whatever. It's going to be such as in decentralised workshops. So people can really have a lot more emphasis on public participation, and people can really talk about what they want, what their experiences are, and be able to share in trying to find a good way forward in policies they want to promote.
Now, I notice on your little leaflet here that it's Ken Loach is speaking. Why have you invited him, and what's he speaking about?
Ken Loach is an international filmmaker who's made films like The Winter Sheets of Barley about the Irish Revolution, and also Land and Freedom, that's about the Spanish Revolution. He's a very good left-wing filmmaker.
And Kez, of course.
And Kez, yeah. Ken Loach has put his name towards the convention, because I think he really wants to support the convention. I think he's keen on supporting this sort of decentralized kind of positive left-wing movement, especially unity movement. He's speaking in the opening session, but also I think he might be taking part in a few of the workshops that he's interested in the day. It's happening in Eastern Community Centre on the 13th of March, Saturday, from 10am till 5pm.
And if people are listening on the internet, where can they find it on the web?
You can go on to the Convention of the Left is a national organisation. That's had conventions in Manchester and Brighton already. So you can go onto their website, which is www.conventionoftheleft.org, or you can look at the event on Indie Media website. It's on Bristol Indie Media.
Okay, that's Dan Isles there, as one of the organisers. Now, Martin, can you just tell us where and when it's taking place?
Well, as Dan said there, it's at Eastern Community Centre tomorrow from 10 till 5, which is, I can't remember the name of the road. Does it say on the leaflet here where Eastern Community Centre is?
It's near a pub called The Plough, isn't it?
It is. It's opposite The Plough.
Okay, and what you mentioned this right at the very beginning. What are you going to be talking about yourself?
Well, I'm going to be talking, I'm not going to talk for long, but we're going to have a discussion about the economy and the unemployment crisis, and I will be participating in that.
Do you think this sort of thing's relevant, Alex? I mean, you probably won't be going yourself, but what do you think about these kind of having these political conventions in the run-up to the election?
You're quite right, I probably won't be going, but no, I think they're a useful way of promoting debate and discussion, and I'd certainly encourage people to go along.
Okay. We did mention the PCS strike earlier on this week, which was the Public Service Union, and we have both of you have given some comments on that. But Alex, what are your thoughts about whether it's right for public sector workers to actually withdraw their labour because they're having their contracts renegotiated? Well, you know, thoughts about the rights and wrongs of doing that?
I don't think there's anything wrong with an employee expressing dissatisfaction with the circumstances that they find themselves in by withdrawing their labour. I'm certainly not the kind of person who's going to oppose strike action. So I don't know the details of the PCS strike, but if they feel that they're sufficiently aggrieved to strike, then obviously there's an issue that needs to be resolved there.
Well, Rebecca Cox is going to tell us now, because BCFM's Anthea Page spoke to her on Tuesday this week.
My name is Rebecca Cox and we're protesting against the proposed changes to the government civil service compensation scheme, which basically means that what they're trying to do is reduce the amount of money that it would have to take to make people redundant, which basically in the long term means that they're intending to make a lot of job cuts, which obviously is very upsetting for a lot of people in the current economic climate.
How many people are we talking about?
Well, what they're saying is that the savings would make, I think, about £500,000 worth of savings. So that means that it's going to be a very large number. We don't know at the moment exactly how many it's going to be, but when you're talking in that sort of numbers financially of the savings that it would cost, when you proportion that across the number of people, it's going to be very high amounts.
When's this likely to happen?
Well, it's probably going to be something that either happens right before the general election in order to kind of hopefully win public support, because the government like to paint us as fat cats with loads of money, which isn't the case, or after the general election, because something needs to be done about the economic climate. But this isn't the thing that needs to be done, because the bankers, they have loads of money, they haven't stopped their bonuses, they're keeping their contractual entitlements, but they're trying to change ours. They always attack us.
How many people in Bristol do you reckon will be affected?
Oh goodness, a very large amount. I mean, there's probably about 100 or so people just in our office.
Which office is this?
This is ACAS, so we do a lot of work regarding employment relations, so we're probably the best people to understand how this is really something that they can't do, because it is a breach of our contract. We do a lot of work with employers and employees trying to resolve employment disputes, and effectively what we are in is our own employment dispute. And so it's going to affect a lot of people in our office. There are a lot of other big departments in Bristol. There's Revenue and Customs, there's the Department of Work and Pensions, there's a Job Centre. Down in Temple Quay, there are a lot of other departments.
What about the tax office? Is that going to be reduced?
That's right, yeah. The tax office is another department where it's likely to make cuts. There's the fear, because we don't know what to expect yet. And the understanding is, well, why on earth would they want to make it cheaper to make us redundant if that isn't their intention in the future? So it's fighting against the unknown, which is often scarier than fighting against what is known.
So how long has this action been going on?
Well, we were balloted probably about a month ago, and we are part of a 48-hour strike. So we striked all yesterday and we're going to strike for the rest of today. And they're having a meeting with the central office of PCS on Thursday. And it's likely that there's going to be more strike action later on this month, because they're planning to impose these changes as of 1st of April.
Have you had any reaction from the government over the strikes?
Some. It's been limited. I mean, there have been talks going on with PCS right up leading to this, but their talks are largely, I mean, Tessa Giles trying to play it down as disappointing, but the difficulty is that they're trying to make significant changes to our work terms and conditions, so that the fact that she's calling it disappointing completely shows her lack of understanding about the full weight of what she's doing.
That's Rebecca Cox there from the PCS Union, who works at ACAS on Welshback, talking to BCFM's Anthea Page on Tuesday this week. Martin and Alex, can we have just a quick one from you? What are your thoughts on the strike? Is it going to is this going to help clear things up, do you think, or not? With the
shall I go first?
Yeah, go on,
I think it's very difficult to have small strikes against pernicious policies like this. If you look to the continent, you will see that in places like France or Greece or Spain, if you want to change the government's economic policy, you need to bring the whole public sector out with private sector support, and you've got to demonstrate a huge support within the society if you want to change the government's direction. I think if we get a government after the next election which is determined to cut public expenditure, then perhaps that's the way we should be thinking about resisting it.
Okay, Alex, quickly.
If we're going to be vaguely political for a moment, I think we've got a government that doesn't have a good record of listening, so while I hope the strikers get what they want, I wouldn't be too optimistic.
Okay, another story this week, and it's one I just came across just as we were coming into the studio. Now, this is one for you, Alex, really, because the Liberal Democrats have selected a pornographic film director to stand as an MP. Have you heard about that one?
I heard it on the radio this morning,
in fact.
Yes,
is this the right kind of direction for the party? I mean, you're the Liberal Party, but this seems to be maybe a bit too liberal.
I don't necessarily think this is the direction of the party. That somehow suggests that in 10 years' time, all of our MPs are going to be pornographic film directors. I think the fact is that ultimately, as a party, we believe in freedom of speech. We believe in the freedom of people to do what they want to do. And if that involves pornography, then so be it. And I don't think it would be reasonable or fair to exclude somebody from being involved in politics just because of the particular job that they do. If that would be like saying that because, I don't know, any one moment, say, solicitors are unpopular, we don't want any solicitors in Parliament. Oh, no, they're all a bunch of lying, thieving scoundrels. Society doesn't work like that. I think I believe in having a representative Parliament, and pornography exists in the world, and why not ensure that there's, if I can put it like this, some of it in Parliament?
lawyers do make a contribution to society, so what's the contribution does pornography make?
Oh, well, then you're getting into a very difficult question there, aren't you? I think
Martin, do you want to help him out?
Well, I actually agree with Alex. There's no particular reason to get upset about somebody being a pornographic film director. The question is, what are his other policies, and what are his policies about the economy and so on? Don't forget, pornography is the biggest thing on the internet, far bigger than little radio shows like this, and it all makes lots of money for people. And we've long ago as a society decided that we're not going to police this. As long as it's consensual and there's no abuse involved, we just say get on with it. And if we're going to say get on with it, well, that means get on with it, doesn't it? It doesn't mean we're going to make a fuss about it.
Okay, next story. You're too old at 57. This is in the Bristol Evening Post for the Bristol TV election debate. A 57-year-old woman says she was left feeling past it after being refused a place in the audience for the televised debate with Gordon Brown, David Cameron and Nick Clegg, which I believe Sky Television are organising, which is taking place in Bristol, one of three national TV debates in the run-up to the election with the main party leaders. So why is someone 57 years old too old to be in the audience of a TV election debate, Alex? Any thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's completely outrageous. If what this lady, Mrs. Williams, is saying is true, then I think that is completely unreasonable. However, I know that ICM, the company concerned, have said that they don't have any age cutoff point, so I don't know what's happened here. I don't know whether there's been a misunderstanding or whether some ICM employee has taken it upon themselves to say this, even though that's not necessarily the company's policy. But I don't think it's at all the situation that certainly any politician would want to say that there's a certain age at which people shouldn't be interested in politics anymore.
Martin?
Well, I mean, if this is the case, then it's obviously shocking and wrong. I suspect.
So can we trust the people who are producing these programmes?
Well, the point is that they're selecting people at random, supposedly, but they're trying to get a cross-section. I mean, like Question Time, when that takes place, people can apply to go on it and they're vetted. But I understand that these debates are going to be chosen at random by this organisation that's doing the choosing. But I mean, if they've got a cut-off point of 54, then I think that's completely absurd, because at least a third of the electorate are over that age. So they've shot themselves in the foot.
Well, one of the other aspects of this is that the Scottish National Party and Plaid Cymru have slammed being the fact that they have been excluded from the debate. The leaders of those two parties protested that the insulting exclusion from TV debates endangered the conduct of a free election. They also warned that the cosy consensus between Labour, Tories and Lib Dems threaten to prevent TV exposure of important issues such as spending billions on Trident. Alex, what are your thoughts about the idea that only the main three party leaders will be taking part in these TV debates?
Well, first of all, I should say I don't think it's the case that there's a cosy consensus between Labour, the Lib Dems and the Tories. That's certainly not the case. There is a real difficulty here, which is that obviously the vast majority of the population of the United Kingdom live in England and probably won't be voting for Plaid Cymru or the Scottish National Party. So why would they want to see Alex Salmond or Ewan Wynne-Jones on a national debate? But there is always the question of where do you draw the line of saying a party is too small to be involved in TV debates or those kinds of things? And this has happened to the Liberal Democrats, of course. And I was listening to Question Time last night, and they were talking about the two main parties, Labour and the Tories. Well, I would argue the Lib Dems are one of the three main parties. But I know certainly the Greens would want to say that they're one of the four main parties, or UKIP would want to say they're one of the five main parties. And you have to draw the line somewhere, otherwise every election you would have just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of random people wanting to appear on the TV for 5 minutes to get their point across. Now,
but the Lib Dems are really doing well out of this, aren't they? Because this is a chance for Nick Clegg to have a big national TV audience and get votes for the Lib Dems, but it's excluding these smaller parties, whereas in the previous elections, for the most part, it's been Conservative and Labour leaders that have had most of the TV coverage.
Well, it's benefiting Labour and the Tories as well, of course, because David Cameron and Gordon Brown also have a chance to appear on TV with a big audience to get Labour and Tory policies across. I think you always have this chicken and egg situation whereby if you don't let parties on the TV, people won't vote for them, but if people won't vote for them, then why should you let them on the TV to get their policies across? And that's a problem that I don't have an answer for.
Well, one of the things that surprises me is that we've only got the SNP and Plaid Cymru here. Why not the Greens complaining? If we've got three different debates, surely we could have the three main party leaders plus one of the debates having an SNP person, one of the debates having someone from Plaid Cymru, and one of the debates having a Green. Martin, what are your thoughts on this? Is this going to be really help people choose how to vote in a general election?
To be honest with you, I don't like the idea that we're choosing a king, which is almost these party leadership debates are becoming. You know, we need actually to concentrate more on policies than personalities. And I think what we're doing here is importing the US system of presidential debates, where the Democrat candidate and the Republican candidate are allowed to slug it out. And that is a two-party, first-past-the-post system where basically it's a kind of referendum on the existing government. I presume Alex is in favour of PR, as I am. If we had PR, then things would be rather different. We'd have at least five parties operating.
Absolutely.
And certainly in peripheral Britain, possibly more. And then the coalitions would have to be formed between those parties. People would grow up and have a bit different... What we seem to be doing in Britain is choosing who's going to be the headmaster for the next 5 years. That's not how politics is done in places like Sweden. Everybody knows that they're voting for a party and for a programme which will then be negotiated, and people are grown up about it. Most other countries are run by a committee. We seem to be run by a chief. And we've got to get away from that.
Okay, Alex, I'll give you the final word on this whole concept of the media and democracy and how important the media is in how people decide how to vote.
Well, the media are incredibly important in helping people to decide how to vote, but that's only because the vast majority of people still do get their information from newspapers and from the television and from the radio. I was actually out canvassing in Kingsdown in my ward last night, and I was chatting to an old Liberal Democrat supporter who was telling me about how 30 years ago she looked at the Liberal, Conservative and Labour manifestos, went through and underlined everything that she supported, and decided on that basis she must be a Liberal because there were more underlinings on our manifesto. I think that most young people today wouldn't do that. They listen to their news, they listen to the sound bites, and they come up with a view on who they're going to vote for based on that. So the media is incredibly important in helping people to decide how they're going to vote.
Do you think it's doing a good job in the run-up to this election?
On the whole, yes. And I think all parties are always going to find things to gripe about with the media, and I know that we Liberal Democrats always say the media are all pro-Labour or pro-Tory. Interestingly, talking to Labour and Tory politicians, they always say, oh, the media, they're pro the other parties. So the poor old media are never going to be able to get it right.
Oh, never mind. OK, so we're joined now by Marina Morris. And Marina, what is your report on this week?
Today we'll talk about suicide. The UK suicide statistics. In the UK, there are about 5,000 suicides a year. More than 100 British people have travelled to Swiss assisted suicide clinic to die. No returning relatives have been prosecuted. Now, European health statistic. The average health span, the time the average European is free from chronic illness, is only 67. And average lifespan is 83. I use European statistic because UK statistics do not appear to be published. The simple maths. The average European will have a long-term health problems for 16 years. 83 minus 67. It's 5,540 days of life this lower quality. In terms of who is responsible for our lack of health and quality of life, who consciously or unconsciously make the choices and decisions. Tony, it's time for a question for you. What do we need to change? First answer. Do we need to change a lifestyle? A new healthy culture which is designed to give us an active and enjoyable life in our later years? Do we need a new policy or more pressure for change to create a law for legal suicide? Or we need to change the government? What's your answer?
I just think we have to change our attitude. You know, that's the most important thing. I think your approach to life is very important.
I agree. Really, who knows the right answer? It depends which authority we accept. One point of view. The planet's human population in 18th century was about 1 billion. In 19th century, 1.7 billion. And now it is about 6.8 billion. Can this growth continue? If we examine the situation only from sufferer's point of view, we might help sufferers to escape from pain and sadness by normalizing euthanasia. Another point of view, are we dealing with so simple perception of our life? What picture can we receive from humanistic point of view? Life is sacred. What about the biggest mystery of life and death? The six commandments in the Old Testament is thou shall not murder. Why are we suffering? What lifestyle did we have? Children copy their parents. Is there a beneficial message to give to your descendants to just accept euthanasia? Or it is time to improve lifestyle and increase health span?
Right, Marina, I'm just going to interrupt you quickly because I want to give Alex a chance to comment before the news on the this whole thing of assisted suicide and whether you think it's such an important issue. I'm a little bit concerned because it seems that the only right we have now is to kill ourselves. Or one of the things that we're, you know, sort of is being pushed at the moment. A lot of our civil liberties are going one way or another, but we do have the right to kill ourselves or to have people help us do it.
Well, I think the issue is that we don't have the right to have people help us do it at the moment. Obviously, this is a moral issue rather than a political one, and I can't give you a Lib Dem perspective on this, but I can give you a perspective as a human being, which is that the government has given us the freedom over the last 40 or 50 years to do so many different things with our own bodies, and ultimately they are our own bodies, whether it's sex or suicide or abortion, and I think that the role of the state in these kinds of issues should be minimal. So I wouldn't say that I'm in favour of assisted suicide. I think all suicide is tragic and all death is tragic. But I do think that people should be able to have the option to end their lives with dignity when they choose.
Okay, continue. The law in the UK. As the law stands in England, Wales and Scotland, deliberate or active euthanasia will normally leave anyone assisting suicide or death liable for murder. The Prime Minister wrote about the new policy on prosecuting assisted suicide. I quote, "The clarification of the circumstances under which those who assist someone to kill themselves may be prosecuted means that the case for a change in the law is now weaker. The chances of euthanasia bill passing successfully through the current parliament are close to zero."
Okay, Marina, I have to hold on there, and we're going to have some vox pops from you after the news, which you've been out on the street this week asking people in Bristol what their thoughts are about assisted suicide. But we're just coming up to the news at 6 o'clock. I'd just like to thank very much our this week's guest, Lib Dem councillor for Cabot Ward and chair of the Central Planning Committee, Alex Woodman. Next week at 5 on Friday, Friday Drive Time. We're joined by Cabinet Member for Children and Young People and Lib Dem Councillor for Henlees, Claire Campion-Smith. After the 6 o'clock news, who is attacking our civil liberties? Is it terrorists or is it the government or both? Drive Time's Richard Cowley reports on the Equiries Act 2005 and why it may make it even more difficult to get to the truth. We also take a look at revelations about the death of Princess Diana by Al-Fayed's barrister Michael Mansfield in today's Daily Mail. And in the week, the first court appearance for MPs and peers in the expenses scandal, we ask, who is ex-SAS Major John Wick? The man with the copy of the private House of Commons hard drive, who started it all. Join us after the news.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.